If someone told you that obsessive-compulsive disorder was quite common, affecting 1 in 100 people, some experts even say 1 in 50 people, you'd probably be surprised. One reason is that most people with the condition work hard to keep their symptoms secret. And as a result, they may not be getting treatments that could bring relief. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. And joining us are Dr. Helen Blair Simpson, an MD, PhD, director of the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at the New York State Psychiatric Institute at Columbia University. She's a specialist in OCD treatment and research. And Dr. Tamar Chansky, the founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. She's the author of several books about anxiety and OCD, including Freeing Your Child from OCD. Welcome to our show.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
And I'm sure that our listeners are going to want to get into this because there are a lot of people out there who have to deal with this. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to our show page at WNYC.org. Tamar, how is obsessive-compulsive disorder defined? And how is it understood in relation to anxiety?
Yeah, so it's defined by the presence of obsessions, which are intrusive thoughts, just you're going about your business doing something and all of a sudden a thought jumps in that may be related, like, oh, what did I just step in? You know, is that going to make me sick? Or it may be unrelated. You know, you're just walking along and you're thinking about, you know, hurting someone or something bad happening to someone. So those are intrusive thoughts. And then compulsions are what we do to try to get rid of the anxiety that those thoughts create for us. So, again, they may be related to the situation, like going and washing your hands, or they may have more of a what we call symbolic connection, like tapping a few times to get rid of a feeling of being dirty rather than washing your hands. So, when people have those symptoms that are significantly interfering with their life or causing a lot of distress or taking more than an hour a day, that's what we call OCD.
Blair, do people tend to be more on one camp or another, or some more obsessive than compulsive, or are they interrelated?
They're often interrelated, and one of the tricks here is that obsessions are thoughts, images, or impulses, and compulsions are either behaviors or they also can be thoughts. So what I mean by that is many people have mental rituals. So everything they do is in their head, but they still have obsessions and compulsions. So most people with OCD have both obsessions and compulsions, and there's often this link, as Tamara just described.
Do men and women tend to have different types of symptoms?
You know, the data on that are not, you can look in different samples and it can look one way or another. And the question is are those really fundamental differences or are they content differences? So that, and what I mean by that is most people with OCD, it's the same thing, intrusive thoughts, images, or impulses, and then these responses, often compulsions or avoidance. But the actual content of the symptom can vary a lot from, as already was described, sometimes it's contamination, sometimes it's concern about harm, it can be concern about things feeling just not right, it can be hoarding. So content may vary, but the form of it is similar between males and females.
Tamar, most people associate OCD with obsessive hand washing or checking to make sure that a door is locked over and over again. Are they the most common symptoms, or are they just the ones that we're most aware of?
Hand washing and contamination fears are the most common type of OCD. But at the same time, if we look at this statistically, the things that come after that are also very common. I mean, what happens in a typical session with a patient is, and this is part of what makes the disorder so crippling, is that they're very afraid of telling you what they've been thinking about because they're sure that they are the only one who's thought that, because it's not about hand washing. And, you know, fortunately, we can reassure that person that this is just garden variety OCD, whatever they might be thinking about, because the mind is sort of endlessly creative. Chances are thousands and thousands and maybe millions and millions of people have had the same experience.
Well, Blair mentioned hoarding. I would assume that most people who hoard do not think of themselves as having OCD, simply don't want to get rid of stuff.
Right. And in fact, the data would support that hoarding, people with hoarding behaviors, it's a bit heterogeneous. So some people have OCD. So people will, for example, have an intrusive thought that harm might befall their beloved relative if they don't keep every version of the Science Times. And now they have them back 50 years, all stacked up in their house. And their fear is, I can't throw that out because someone might need it. That's quite different, we think, today than the person who doesn't have that intrusive thought that begins it or the anxiety, but really just has difficulty discarding. And actually, the field is moving towards separating that out, that latter part out from OCD, and calling it separably hoarding disorder. So the bottom line of it is some hoarding behaviors might be part of OCD and some are not.
I'm talking with Drs. Tamar Chomsky and Helen Blair Simpson about OCD on today's Please Explain. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned, Tamar mentioned, people who might save back issues of Science Times. I knew a kid, actually a teenager, who wouldn't touch certain steps as he walked down the hall to the front door because if he did, something terrible would happen. The same kind of idea?
No. So the way the field sort of thinks about it now is that there are lots of different content to that same form, obsession and compulsion, but they're different themes. One theme is contamination. Another theme is if I don't do something just right, I might actually feel something feels off or magically some harm might befall someone else.
There's a magical component in many
exactly.
of these obsessions.
Another theme can be, again, harm will befall me or someone else. Another theme is taboo forbidden thoughts, things like aggressive images or sexual or religious images, which people are horrified. They would never want to pursue these thoughts. So that's the point, which is the content of obsessions and compulsions can vary from individuals, between individuals, but almost all individuals have the form, an obsession and a compulsion.
Although,
I hope that's clear.
Yes. In some cases, I guess people could not fake it. I've heard of a woman who refused to go outdoors because she was sure the air contained germs that would kill her. Is that an extreme case?
I would say no. What about you, Tamar? Meaning, unfortunately, if you work with people who have this disorder, there are many, many things that will sound very, very bizarre to people who don't know this disorder. But in
that
fact,
involves breathing.
Yes. Well, I could regale you with other stories, but I won't. I mean, that's the other interesting thing about OCD is there is a range of sort of bizarreness to the symptoms. And so sometimes these patients can get wrongly diagnosed as psychotic because someone will hear that and say, well, that sounds psychotic. Well, that's one of the differentials you have to make as a clinician. Sometimes this isn't psychotic. This is OCD with what we call poor insight.
But they're hearing voices in some cases, aren't they? And is that why we would connect it to psychosis?
Right. So that's very different. So what someone with a psychotic disorder looks like is a very different profile. More my point is that sometimes people with obsessions and compulsions, sometimes they come to my office and they'll say, I know this doesn't make any sense. I know that I'm not going to get sick by using the public bathroom in Grand Central, but I can't stop myself from washing all the time. And other people come to my office, and they're not so sure that they don't have to wash. And that's what I mean by a range of insight into how much they really are at risk if they don't do their behaviors.
Tamar, when was OCD first identified? And
Goodness.
What did people think was causing these problems for their patients before OCD was identified?
Right. Well, there is a long, long, dark history to OCD. I don't know the earliest example, but there are, going back hundreds and hundreds of years of religious figures being afraid that you know, they would say something blasphemous, and so they would hold their hand over their mouth to make sure that, you know, those things wouldn't be said. And at the time, you know, all sorts of explanations were given that there was devil possession or, you know, they were evil in some way. Fortunately, fast forward, you know, to the latter part of the last century, and, you know, we now have an understanding that this is absolutely a no-fault medical condition, in a sense, that this is something that is a glitch in the brain that fortunately, with treatment, that people are really able to handle in a different way and take charge of their lives.
So, Blair Tomeau said it's a glitch in the brain. Is this chemical or is it neurological? Is there a genetic component to it?
Sure. So, this is always an interesting, I want to make a distinction. When we talk about what causes OCD, there are two different ways to think about causes. One is, if I have normal behavior or abnormal behavior, in the end, my brain is what enables me, for example, to speak to you. And if I have funny thoughts, then that's my brain too. And so what we know about what's been associated with these types of symptoms are abnormal functioning in a particular circuit in the brain, linking parts of the cortex to parts of the striatum. And there may also be a role with parts of the amygdala, the fear circuitry. However, that doesn't answer the question, well, how did my brain get like that? And that's, I would call, etiology. And when we think about, well, how come I have a brain like that that gives me OCD symptoms and someone else doesn't, there we know less. And the best I can say is the current model suggests that there's a genetic vulnerability that some people may have, although unfortunately it's been very frustrating and difficult to really identify clear genes, at least specifically for OCD. There may be shared genes that might make you vulnerable to a range of disorders. So that's one piece.
Well, would it be likely that if a parent had OCD that a child would have it?
So what the family studies suggest is that the normal rate of OCD in the population is 1.6%. If you've got OCD, there are 10% of your family members will have OCD. So there is, family studies do suggest a higher rate. But when you look at the data, it suggests some people have family members and some people don't. So it's a long way of saying, as we think in terms of what causes it, there might be a vulnerability, genetic vulnerability, and there's good data for that from twin studies and family studies, but something else also has to be going on, and we think it's something about the developmental trajectory and environmental influences together with that genetic vulnerability that may lead someone, unfortunately, to develop OCD or not to develop OCD, even if they have that vulnerability.
Tamar, how early can the disorder express itself? You deal with children.
Do
some of them have it in infancy?
Well, I'll tell you, I think my experience is consistent with the field in general, which is I have treated kids who are as young as 3 or 4 who have something different. You know, people might be thinking, wait a minute, but 3 and 4-year-olds are very ritualized in their behavior. You know, my son requires the blue cup every day. It's different from that. It's, you know, it gets off that developmental, you know, sort of typical track, and it really takes a different direction. So it can start very young. Typically with kids, though, the age of onset is around 10 or 11.
So, but it still must be incredibly difficult for children to understand that their obsessive thoughts need not be listened to, or that if they don't have to do something they feel desperately compelled to do, otherwise something terrible will happen.
You know what is just amazing, though, is that often kids come to me with some of the treatment already done, and what I mean by that is they've already separated themselves from the OCD in this way. They know that it's coming from some different part of them. So I had a child who says, you know, how do I get my brain to forget things? You know, or my stomach is telling me things that I don't think are right. Or, you know, my heart is saying that I have to do certain things, but I don't want to. Those kids, you know, can go right to the head of the class because basically, you know, what what we do with this knowledge about what OCD is about, that it's, you know, that it is, it comes from this you know, varied glitch in the brain, is that the bottom line is it's unreliable, that the rules that it talks about, though they, you know, talk about very important things, people being safe or getting sick, hurting people, that it doesn't have the authority that it seems to command. And so the treatment is really about step-by-step disregarding that authority and breaking the rules of OCD, doing the thing anyway. Kids are really ready to be in charge of their lives. They're often the best patients.
We'll talk more about treatment and take our listeners' calls and questions. People have been writing in as well. Right after we take a little break, my guests are Dr. Tamar Chansky, the founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania, and the author of several books, including Freeing Your Child from OCD, and Dr. Helen Blair Simpson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Clinic at the New York State Psychiatric Institute of Columbia University. She's a specialist in OCD treatment and research. The number again, 212-433-9692, or leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. We are back with today's Please Explain look at OCD. Doctors Helen Blair Simpson, director of the Anxiety Disorder Clinic at New York State Psychiatric Institute, Columbia University, and Tamar Chansky, the founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And let's go right to some of those calls. Patricia from Upper Manhattan, you're on the air.
Yes, I've had OCD since I was 5 years old. And I've had it for 60 years. And it has, I won't say ruined my life, but it has been a heavy burden. But part of it is a little comical, because as I got older, I became disabled and could not cater to the OCD, which entailed having everything within my realm perfect. And I have a child who has ADD, so the combination is a little comical and difficult.
Now, a number of listeners actually have called in to ask whether there is a link between OCD and ADD, and whether sometimes OCD isn't misdiagnosed because it's really ADD. You want to start, Tamar?
Well, with anxiety in general, anxiety and ADD can look similar from the outside, because both anxiety and ADD distract you and from what's going on, and make it difficult to focus and may make you jumpy. But really what it comes down to is what is the source of the distraction. So for anxiety, it's going to be worry about things in your mind, whereas with ADD, it's going to be more coming from the outside, the things around you, that it's hard to keep your focus.
But I think that she's also, as Patricia's also asking, whether there isn't a link. She has a child with ADD.
So some children can have both. They talk about sort of the magic triangle with kids who have OCD, ADD, and Tourette's. So often putting all those letters together, oftentimes kids can have a combination of three. But maybe Blair can talk about the genetics of that.
And Blair, Tourette's seems like a form of OCD, is it?
Well, there's a debate in the field whether you'd call OCD a form of Tourette's or Tourette's a form of OCD, but there does seem to be a tic-related OCD, and that may have a different genetic vulnerability to it than non-tic-related OCD. And often tic-related OCD, which means tic disorders are either in the person with OCD or might even be in their family, that's often where ADHD often ends up too. I wanted to just underscore Patricia's point, which is, you know, what sometimes people don't realize about this disorder, because some people can keep it hidden. And if half the cases start by age 19 and a quarter by age 14, what it means is a lot of people have these symptoms early in life. And the burden of it is, it's not just the symptoms, but the symptoms get you off track. and they get you off track because maybe you have trouble graduating from high school or graduating from college or getting that first job or moving out. And over a whole lifetime, you know, it can really add up to a lot of burden. So I work in an adult clinic, and even when we can treat people's symptoms in their 30s or 40s, I can't give them back their childhood. And I think that's the hidden tragedy, actually, of OCD. And Tamar, I always have a sense of that's where we need to go, is we need to intervene earlier and help children and adolescents early before they get off track.
Absolutely. And you know, treating primarily children, although I also see adults, the prognosis for kids is so good because the treatment. So what we really need is more therapists who know how to do it. You know, the treatment is fairly easy to implement, and the first step is always the hardest, but kids do really start to, you know, get on board and feel proud of what they're able to do. And, you know, while, you know, even a year or so in a child's life is tragic to, you know, they lose social interaction and their academics may suffer, but at the same time, when they gain control, they also oftentimes gain a lot of resilience and flexibility and just understanding of the complexity of life, which they're able to do very good things with.
Now, there are two approaches to treatment, aren't there? There is the non-medication treatments, and then there are the medications. The two of you represent both sides of that story. Tamar, you use cognitive behavioral therapy, don't you?
Absolutely. But, you know, I really think that the most common scenario, and really research has borne this out, is that a combination of treatments is most effective. And so, you know, working on different systems and parts of the brain, that what can happen is that medication can really help to reduce the anxiety that patients feel about, in kid terms, breaking OCD's rules, so they're able to engage in the treatment. And then the cognitive behavior therapy really teaches people how to interact again with those situations that they've been avoiding or they've been, you know, interacting with in a very ritualized way. They really forget, you know, how do you just wash your hands? How do you just walk through a doorway without, you know, doing it 10 times?
You have to, you force them, you expose them to the things they fear, and then they see that it didn't kill them or didn't cause the problems that they expected, and
right.
That allows them to get past it.
Yeah, and I appreciate your change of language there, because I always say to my patients, you know, I have the strategies, but you are in charge. So I wouldn't, some people, I want people to feel very welcomed and comfortable with behavior therapy, that it's not about forcing people to do things, but it's really about providing the opportunity, as you say, to learn that the bad thing doesn't happen. You know, tragedy doesn't happen. No one gets sick. No one gets hurt. And deep down, most people do know that that's the case. They're really feeling like they have to protect themselves about something that could happen or might happen, but the risk of that is really small.
And Blair, will antidepressants work here? Do they help alleviate the symptoms?
They do. So they're two, as Tamar's saying, they're two first-line treatments. One is pharmacotherapy with a class of medications called serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So it's not all antidepressants that work. It's antidepressants that work on the serotonin reuptake inhibitor, things like Prozac or Paxil or sertraline, things like that. And the other one is this very particular type of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is called exposure and ritual prevention. I, by training, am a psychiatrist, but in fact, as a research fellow, I was trained by Dr. Edna Foa and Michael Kozak in how to do this exposure and ritual prevention treatment. And I have to say, it felt like giving someone, when it worked, it was like giving a sick person an antibiotic because the effect could be so dramatic in the people that worked. So, in fact, my clinic has done comparative studies between medication and this particular psychotherapy in patients with OCD, and we've also studied how best to combine it. And, in fact, in people who can actually do the treatment, the therapy, with really skilled therapists, and who really do the homework, in fact, it looks as good, if not better, than medication. And well, that's very interesting when you think about the brain.
Have medications been developed that are specifically aimed at OCD?
Well,
isn't there one called ondansetron?
Well, ondansetron is actually being used as an augmentation. So the only medications approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of OCD are these serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Again, not other antidepressants, but antidepressants with this effect. But here's, and serotonin reuptake inhibitors really can work. Maybe, you know, 60% of people will have a response to medication. But unfortunately, what they typically do is reduce symptoms. They typically, on average, don't make all the symptoms go away. So people are often left with residual symptoms that often are pretty still significant. I mean, if you're obsessing and compulsing 6 hours a day and it drops to three, on the one hand, you've got 3 hours back in your life. And on the other hand, you're still obsessing and compulsing 3 hours a day. And so a lot of attention has been paid to what's the best way to augment serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Ondansetron is one investigational medication that's now being studied in a large multi-site trial funded by industry to see whether ondansetron might be a way to boost the effects of serotonin reuptake inhibitors, although there are other strategies that have also been tried in that domain.
In fact,
I would say we have data that cognitive behavioral therapy is the best way to boost the effects of serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Teresa from the Bronx, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you so much for doing this show. First of all, I want to tell you I'm using a pseudonym because even though OCD is not malicious, I'm really embarrassed at having it. I mean, I've had it probably since I was a young kid, maybe age three, and then I recognized it when I was 17, but I still feel embarrassed. And I'm a working full-time professional right now, and I still don't want to admit to people I have it because not only do they not understand it, I don't even understand it. Now, first of all, I want to say that I'm not psychotic. I know that for a fact. My mother was psychotic, and I grew up in a very strict Catholic environment. And my symptoms got really bad after I had to hospitalize her. And then all of a sudden, I felt like everything was out of control, and I think the OCD was my way of controlling things. But what ended up happening is my dad, who probably had other crazy neurotic things, he used to make fun of me. And that's really what I want to tell patients. The worst thing you can do to a child is to ridicule them or make fun of them because it causes more anxiety and you get even worse. So you have to have a lot of compassion with your child. Don't ever make fun of them because they're doing something that looks crazy, because I don't even understand why I do the things that I do. And the good news is that...
And they're not going to embarrass you out of doing them.
Say it again?
And by ridiculing you, they're not going to embarrass you out of doing these things.
No, no, absolutely. It makes it worse. You become more anxious and you do more of these rituals and you feel humiliated. You never even want to leave the house. So luckily, I was able to get control. I went to all these different studies, and now I'm taking Pexiva, and it seems to work pretty well, but I also need to do more behavioral therapy. So who's the therapist there? I need to go to your clinic. Is it Tamar or Helen?
Both.
Both. I'll be there tonight. Okay. But that's the biggest point I just want to make, that you really have to have compassion with your child and, you know, just work with them the best you can.
So, doctors, where does she find a place to have that kind of therapy?
Where do you live?
She lives in the Bronx.
Yes. So, you know, Tamar will know in Pennsylvania. So in New York City, there are, in fact, a number of places around the city and also in the Bronx. If she looks up my clinic, if people call us and we don't have a research study that fits them, we actually help find them, guide them to referral places and have a list.
And your clinic is the Anxiety Disorders Clinic.
Anxiety Disorders Clinic, and the general number is 212-543-5366. So we do research studies, all our treatments at no cost, but if we don't have something that is right for you, we do have a list of people who we refer to. And there are people in fee-for-service practices and their community practices. The real key, though, is getting, I think, and Tamar, I'm sure, would agree with me, you really want someone who's seen a lot of people with OCD and done a lot of this treatment, because it's not cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. It's really, to be really done well, it really needs to be done not only, you know, it needs to be done with science, but also with a lot of art, because mm-hmm. you're asking people to walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you know, to expose them just with, you know, taking their hand. And you have to really design it correctly and give them the right sort of support so that they're successful.
Okay, Teresa, thank you for calling us. Our next caller is Joe from Maine. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Came to Maine from New York several years ago, but I've never stopped listening to you, and I always try
Yeah,
to
Joe,
listen.
We don't have a lot of time.
Okay.
Sorry.
I want to know how having a number of symptoms to a moderate degree compares to having maybe one of them very seriously. So I have
And we have about 30 seconds. Anybody want to answer?
I have a locked door once a week, the oven problem once a week, somewhat intrusive thoughts, but only when I listen to music. And I hoard photos, but, that's the only thing I hoard are my photos.
So what do you say in 30 seconds?
My quick answer is, if you wanted to do a little bit of behavioral therapy, you could probably knock those off pretty quickly.
And that's something that
and
he can do in Maine as well, I assume.
Absolutely, but again, if you don't, if it's not really impairing your functioning and it's not a big issue in your life, you may not want to do it. But it is important to emphasize that these symptoms vary. Some people have mild symptoms. Some people have very severe symptoms. Many people have more than one symptom.
And we thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain, Dr. Helen Blair Simpson, director of the Anxiety Disorders Clinic, New York State Psychiatric Center, Columbia University, and Dr. Tamar Chomsky, founder and director of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania.